But I must also remind you at the beginning that, of course, we have left out more than we put in, and that the idea was never the coverage, but the problem. There are many things you did not cover. The most obvious one you can think of from Wagner. I have no idea why we didn't cover Wagner, except I'm bored with Wagner. I've written so much about Wagner. I love to listen to Wagner, but I don't want to talk about him anymore. We haven't done anything about Wagner, and of course, there are a lot of things. We haven't done much about music, hardly anything. That's my fault as usual, because I have no ear for modern music. The last music that I appreciate is Richard Strauss. After the First World War, for me, there is no longer any music. That's just noise. That's what I have, therefore. I couldn't do anything for you on music. There should have been something on jazz, for which France was the center. Le jazz hot jazz in France. We haven't done anything about a lot of things, that must be clear to you. But the idea was, of course, to cover the main problems and not cover the content for which you had the culture of Western Europe in any case. As I say, the biggest thing that has been missing is really music on the whole. But if you did all your reading, you would have gotten, I think, a certain amount of coverage, and so I don't really feel too bad about it. But problems like problems of community and change and politics, these are the important problems which I want to talk about a little more now, rather than the coverage. But your exams should also have helped you a little to synthesize and to cover things, because the broadness of the questions, you will have realized, especially of the final, was supposed to help you pull things together in your own mind. Now, it is obviously true that dealing with modern culture, as we have really in the 20th century, we've dealt with a rather bewildering array of cultural movements, and yet, in another sense, there has been a very great sameness of all those movements we have dealt with. And the sameness is that they all define themselves in a way against the existing establishment. If there is another critique about the course, is that we don't deal enough with the establishment itself. You have read Jenny Tribal. That's about the only establishment reading that you have done. All the other readings are movements which define themselves against the establishment. And there is a reason for it, because we have always looked to the future. And from the beginning of this course, that is to say, from 1870, roughly, what comes in the future, whether you think of artistic movements or political movements, comes against the establishment rather than from within the establishment. Though it isn't as simple as that, it is, as I've said many times before, a anti-bourgeois revolution. But still, even so, it is defined against the establishment rather than in the establishment itself. I must say, therefore, that you have seen European culture rather through the eyes of those who oppose it. And the problem is always the same that this gets us into. The problem is that, as a matter of fact, most, even of the cultured middle classes, what they read, what they thought, isn't too exciting. It isn't avant-garde. It doesn't look to the future. It has a rhythm that is very similar, the rhythm of popular literature. And indeed, we haven't really dealt a lot with popular literature on two levels. The popular literature which the lower classes read, which is the Cinderella story by and large, sentimental Cinderella story, clear distinction between good and evil, the fairy tale sort of thing. Which you have today in television with the Western and other things. It doesn't really change from the 1870 till the Western on television today. For the lower classes, popular culture is essentially a fairy tale, a Cinderella, the hope of rising in the world through the pure and good heart. All of this, together, of course, with a kind of adventure stories, and detective stories, all of that. The detective stories we could have said much more about, but which start not till about the 1870s, properly speaking, but which are a part of the quest of adventure. So that I would say we have not really dealt with popular culture in the large. Popular culture in the large is a quest out of industrial society, obviously, out of the bind of the existential situation, which all we have treated is a part of. But it gets out of it by stressing, in a way, a kind of pre-industrial society, the Cinderella, the fairy tale. Fairy tales are always rural in the country, the good and evil, the adventure. All of this is popularly culture, and we haven't said a great deal about it, and popular art is the same way. And even for those who are on a higher level of culture and education, most of your more cultured middle classes, this would be much the same. Their reading would be Cinderella on perhaps a higher level, a little, adventure stories, eventually detective stories, and of course, up-to-date fairy tales, that is to say, nostalgia reading for a society, a pre-industrial society, for a society of utopias. For it is quite correct, I think, that in a sense, part of the sameness of all of this, popular culture on these levels, what we've seen, culture against those who opposed the establishment, however they did it, they opposed the establishment, all of them surely have something in common in their majority. That is to say, the opposition to industrialism, the opposition to positivism. And because that is so, you really get something quite different. You get, in a way, the neo-romanticism, as we call it, the new romanticism. That is the new way, if you like, to look backward to pre-industrial society. Now, there are exceptions, the futurists, the expressionists, those who accepted the speed of time. We've talked about them. But finally, in fascism, but not only in fascism, I think, also in victorious communism today, you get a kind of beauty at work, a kind of mixture of the utopia and the technology. You get technology disguised as a pre-industrial utopia, always. And, of course, that goes in again. The First World War strengthens it a great deal, because the whole war experience, and I hope I made that clear to you, is in a way a pre-industrial utopia. That is to say, how the people in the war looked at nature, how they used nature as mediation, the mountains, the whole cult of the mountains, the whole cult of aviation. All of this combines technology and utopia. For it must be quite clear to you that the new view of looking at nature now is, we can perhaps say it, threefold. You look at nature, it's pure utopia in a fairy tale, all right? The fairy tales are now extremely, extremely important. And in fact, people now write fairy tales. There are modern fairy tales, but they're all the same. The fairy is a pre-industrial thing. You can't think of a fairy at the assembly line, can you? It's pre-industrial. And the colors, the golden slippers, are reminiscent of the sun, and so on, the wood, and all of this is a pre-industrial nostalgia, which goes into much of neo-romantic literature. That's one way of thinking. But there's a second way of having this kind of pre-industrial nostalgia. And that is, of course, through the mediation. That is to say, nature becomes a reminder. And nature itself becomes a utopia. That is to say, the snowy mountains, as the last gospel for man's adventure. Now, the most famous German movie star after the war, Louis Trenker, who made these mountain movies, said what you get everywhere: bad people do not climb mountains. In other words, the mountains are a symbol of adventure, of goodness, of getting away from a society. And this becomes a cult you know best from Germany. You know it from Leni Riefenstahl, who made a debut in mountain films. You know it from Louis Trenker. And the whole idea of mountain and mountain films. And similarly, I would say, in literature, in Thomas Mann in Germany, in The Magic Mountain, the snow is really a symbol of eternity. Snow and glaciers now become symbols of eternity. That is to say, the mountain mediates between you and utopia. It is the last symbol. For Americans, it's the wide open spaces. But remember, Europe had no wide open spaces. So together with the mountain, a symbol of the last adventure, of symbol, if you like, and goodness of man, you get a second symbol, the American Indian. That is why that wave in Europe of American Indian story, because it gives you a space that is no longer there in Europe. The American Indian becomes the noble savage, the equivalent of mountain climbers, the noble savage, the good. There is, in European literature, no really bad American Indian. They are the noble savage. They still are the noble savage. When I was down in Oklahoma a few weeks ago to talk to American Indians, they'd come back from Germany and they'd been appalled. In Germany, they'd been treated like noble savages. I mean, they'd been treated like kings or gods. And I feel towards American Indians similarly, having been brought up with this kind of idea that the American Indian is the mediation between industrial society and innocence. But innocence as adventure, as the wide open space. So you get nature as a symbol. And I would say for Europe, it's not only the Alps, it's the plain of North Dakota and the plains of South Dakota, which become the substitute, if you like, for Europeans. Nature is a mediation. And so is the great new technology, aviation, is the mediation. The pilot is the adventurer. There are no bad pilots. In the war, the Air Force had a special status. And in the war, pilots had a special chivalry. And again, you get what I've always stressed in this course, the idea of mediation. For example, in the First World War, when an ace was shot down, a German ace was shot down by the English, the British aviator would fly over the German lines and drop wreaths on his funeral, join his funeral. So there was actually a lot of chivalry. And when in the war an aviator was shot down and captured, he was never treated as a prisoner of war. He was adopted by, if it's an English aviator, he was adopted by the German Air Force, and vice versa. So there was a great deal of chivalry there. And of course, it became again a symbol of the open spaces and a symbol of adventure, which was no longer possible in industrial society. You have this symbol of adventure of the aviator, and I don't have to tell you that the status of some people in fascism, like Goering in Germany or Italo Balbo in Italy, was based on their status of aviator. And Italian fascism indeed organized these mass flights across the Atlantic. That was something I heard of. Because, after all, these mass flights show that fascism annexed this kind of myth. So you must remember that there is a new idea of nature, and it's on two levels. Not only the sentimental level of the pictures in your landlady's room, but also on the level of nature as mediation. The longing, which we've always had, for adventure. And after the war, this becomes incorporated in some general literature. In Germany, it's Walter Flex, but in England, it is, of course, T.H. Lawrence, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which I think every Englishman has read. Every semi-educated or educated Englishman has read. And you get something else from them. T.H. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom are the adventures of Lawrence during the war in Arabia. And in England, you get the worship of Arabia. What the North American plains are to the Germans, Arabia is to the English. T.H. Lawrence made it so. Adventure, wide open spaces, all of that. You probably know the movie. It's all wrong. It's all wrong. It's all a myth. In reality, T.H. Lawrence wasn't at all that way. But he made his own myth, and it was a myth that hit home, because to England, Arabia. So you get all these English ladies who love Arabs and Arabia. Yes, Gertrude Bell in Mesopotamia. After all, the woman who did more for Mesopotamia, now Iran, is Gertrude Bell. You get in England, oh, this plays into anti-Zionist politics and everything in England. It's still today. This great admiration for Arabia, and what the American Indian is to Germans, the Arab is to England, are the last free spirit roaming the open spaces, which you don't have between London and Birmingham, let me assure you, and the open spaces, the adventure, which you can no longer have in the home country or anywhere else. So you have it here too, again, a kind of mediation, which can be the landscape primitive. Not all primitives, not the blacks, because the blacks are involved in racism. You have to have somebody who's outside racism. Racism was never concerned very much with the Arabs, for certain reasons, and certainly never with the American Indians, so that they could be regarded as noble savage. They were brave and courageous. And finally, they were a male society. That is all important. And I'll come back to that, because you've learned enough now to know, I think, that the European ideal, strengthened through the war, but before, was very much a male society, a male stereotype in this regard. The Arabs are always males, the American Indians are always males. There hardly any squaws in any of this Indian literature, either in Germany or France, where they were so popular, and there hardly any squaws. So it goes in again with the male society. So first of all, we must be clear that in a sense we have dealt with utopias, and it's always dealing with utopias, because that is one of the very deep urges to get out of the bind, to get out of industrial society, to get out of claustrophobia. Only good people climb mountains, remember. And only good people are pilots. I mean, this was when flying was still an adventure, you understand. Only good people are pilots. And the snow and the glacier and the American Indians and the Arabs, they stand, in fact, for pre-industrial society. A pre-industrial society glorified, not the wretched society. So what you have here always, remember, is the tendency to make myths. Is the tendency to make myths about people and nature. But the noble savage is by no means finished. The noble savage is with it. But within that, of course, the question is always, how can we change things? How can we change things? And change things, really, in the restoration of the individual. For all this utopia has a great individualism to it. These mountain films are individuals who climb mountains. Mountain climbing isn't a collective affair. It restores courage. It gives the individual something that industrial society doesn't. All of this nature is individualized. That is to say, only the restoration of the individual in industrial society. Now, this can, of course, lead to despair. And there were many who accepted the decline of individualism. But it's astonishing how few really accepted the decline of individualism, which is a reality in industrial society. The more dense a society becomes, the less the individual occurs. Now, obviously, that acceptance is much stronger after the war. Now, you remember, perhaps, but I recall it to you, that even the individual expressionists through the war became socialists. That is to say, tended to sublimate their individualism in a collectivity. And I told you how Ernst Jünger, in his war diary, began to substitute we for I and a lot of things. In other words, the collectivity was accepted, but mostly if it was accepted, it was combined with individualism. For the collectivity that was accepted was a collectivity which is, in the old distinction from 1870, community and not society. And when you say community and not society, you're really saying, I want to have my cake and eat it. A community of affinity, a community of individualists, which the German youth movement traced, but which I remind you, nationalism had always put forth. A community of affinity, people who would join voluntarily because they had the same race or the same history or whatever. Where a community of affinity who joined voluntarily. And, of course, that was the great strength in the end of fascism, of socialism, of a part of socialism. And indeed, if you look at the collectivity after 1918, you will see that apart from Bolshevism, it was almost on every level a community of affinity which was so attractive. That you joined because you wanted to join. It's the old distinction. But I remind you of something else that's typical, that the distinction doesn't come till a German sociologist called Tönnies, who made it in the 1870s, between community and society, society and force, community and voluntary collectivity. But this idea of a voluntary collectivity, of course, meant an encouragement for nationalism, much more than socialism. It's one reason socialism lost out. Because nationalism had long ago annexed it. Nationalism had more or less monopolized it, co-opted it. And therefore, nationalism could really best provide that image or operate on that kind of image. But I remind you again that the image became reality, and it became reality in the new mass politics of which Le Bon wrote. That is to say, that you participate voluntarily in politics through marches, through mass meetings, through all of these things, so that you have, in a way, direct democracy going hand in hand in modern mass politics and mass movement. So this idea of collectivity came alive, not in socialism, but in nationalism and fascism, through their adaptation of mass politics, which, and we've been over this before, is for many people the real participation, not parliamentary politics at all. There were, of course, people who began to despair more and more. And we have left them out because there's a whole chapter about them in the culture of Western Europe, above all the existentialists of one sort or another, with Sartre's famous story, you're shot on the wall, you don't know why, you shrug. Kafka, the existentialist, Céline, all these people, if you were really people who despaired. And Céline wrote in one of the most famous novels, which if you haven't read it, it's a big culture gap, among many culture gaps, I'm sure. This is a very big culture gap, Journey to the End of the Night, one of the greatest of all ever written European novels of Céline. And in that novel, which is, in fact, a novel of despair and degeneration. He has many lines, but one of them which is fairly famous, and will bring it home to you, is when his hero says, I called help, help, just to see whether people would take any notice. None whatever. They were pushing life and the night and the daytime before them. Life hides everything from them. In the midst of their noise, they hear nothing. They don't give a damn. And the bigger the town and the higher the town, the less they bloody well care. I'm telling you, I've tried, and it's no use. Now, this kind of an idea, which is an existentialist idea, you also find, of course, in Sartre, in the early Sartre, I think in the only Sartre that's any good, that's my judgment. In the early Sartre, you find the same kind of idea in his story, The Wall, that all you can do is really a shrug, really. But it is typical that these people tell you to become fascist. Céline became a fascist because he needed form in the end. He needed something to hold on to. And he became a fascist, and he founded the fascist party and all of that sort of thing, and went in for honesty against hypocrisy, all of that kind of thing you have here. But another kind of despair is, of course, Spengler, this vision of the barbaric, the new primitive, the new collections in Europe of African art. For a while, there wasn't a European academic who didn't have a scholar of some African art in his group. Yeah? And that wasn't necessarily because he liked Africans. That was genuine. The genuine and the primitive were often confounded now, yes? Like Spengler's barbarian. And that's a similar longing, not for the noble savage. The noble savage isn't a primitive. In the German Indian legend, Winnetou is really a Christian. The Indians of Karl May, the chief German writer of Indians, they were really Christians. They behaved very well in North Dakota. They celebrated Christmas on the plains of North Dakota and Christmas. Well, that can't say anything about Indians like that. But the other despair is really primitivism. They're Spengler's barbarians who go around and who beat people up. And this trend remains. It becomes a kind of admiration for Africa and African art. It's in nationalism again, in the peasant cult. It's very much, especially in Germany, in the peasant cult. And it surfaces again after the Second World War in a writer called Ernst von Salomon, Questionnaire, where the great primitives are now the SS in American camps. So part of the admiration for fascism is undoubtedly an admiration for primitivism. And the primitivism involved there, the longing for brutality. Now, it's a fact, and I'll come back to that if I have time, I may not, that it's a funny thing about intellectuals. Intellectuals have a great longing for brutality. The great admiration among the faculty of the University of Wisconsin for Jimmy Hoffa, for example, and things like that. Intellectuals not only want to join crowds, they want to beat up. And, of course, they can't. Yes, so they're little puny runs. So it just doesn't work. So they have this great love for primitivism and primitives. In all my life, it's always astonished me. But they always have great love for primitives. And you mustn't underrate that as one attraction of fashion. This attraction for the primitive. And certainly with Ezra Pound, there's no doubt about it. Even with T.S. Eliot, I think it's in there. This attraction not only for form, but for this kind of primitivism, which is another utopia, the barbarian. All right, civilization is bunk. Let's go back to barbarian. And of course, it goes back to Nietzsche. Nietzsche's barbarians are Spengler's barbarians, are the peasants of much of German nationalist peasant literature, and are, in the end, the SS. That is really the history of the barbarian in Europe. The new barbarian, from Nietzsche, if you like, to Spengler, to the peasants, German peasant literature, Luns and others, and after Luns and the peasants, you get the SS. The SS are generally regarded as the new barbarian, and there was a storm troop in Italian fascism, which was regarded similarly. So there is the idea of despair, which leads to primitivism. It's not just because, in the last resort, as I told you, people can't keep up. You can't be a Nietzsche, and you can't keep up that despair. Sartre becomes a kind of Marxist in the end, the pretty dogmatic one in the end, because you can't keep up that despair. And you can't keep it up, so you become a fascist, you become a Marxist, or you become a barbarian. So, but it's very difficult to keep up this kind of shrug. Because nobody really shrugs if he's about to be shot. I don't know what people do, but they hardly shrug and say so forth. At the same time, the restoration of individualism is not only in the collectivity. It also shows itself in the new hero and hero worship. Now, that is clear, and that is something else that we have more or less omitted because it's in the book, the hero worship. The hero worship goes together with the barbarians. It comes to us from the 19th century. Carlyle and all that. And from Carlyle to Hitler and Mussolini. So why this sudden hero worship? Well, obviously, again, it's out of industrialism. But it also has to do with the decline of Christianity. The hero is kind of a substitute god, obviously, yes? A substitute god. As long as Christianity was alive and well, you didn't need a human hero. You had the Mass. You had Christ coming to you every Sunday. You didn't really need a human hero in that sense. But with the decline of Christianity, at the same time that you have this quest for individualism, you get hero and hero worship. And that, of course, again has a line from Carlyle to Wagner's heroes to the political heroes later on. And that these heroes are also pre-industrial heroes. Whether Hitler or Mussolini or Wagner's heroes or anyone else, these are not heroes of the working class. These are not workers. The heroes are never workers. The heroes present themselves as agricultural endeavors. And that goes in, of course, the fascist leaders who love to be photographed, you know, harvesting or doing some agricultural thing or climbing mountains or for Mussolini running, you know, jogging. Mussolini was the first jogger. Remember that jogging is a fascist activity. So what you have is you jog. But you jog for pre-industrial nostalgia. Of course, that's why you do it, I'm sure. For pre-industrial nostalgia, it's a kind of climbing mountains. You have no mountains, so you jog. But anyway, all this is part of hero worship. But the hero worship was, and I must come back to that, after the war, after 1918, integrated into the community. And you had again your cake and eat it. You had the hero and you had the community, especially in fascism, where the fascist leaders didn't think themselves as standing above the people. They were just a little bit better. And this idea of leadership, which comes from the German youth movement and from other politics already of the 1880s, that the leader or the hero is one of you. He is one of the collectivity, except he does better what the collectivity does. You have it in Le Bon. The hero idea you read about in Le Bon, that really combines again hero worship and the collectivity itself. Now all of this that I have talked about can be summarized in another way. It can be summarized in the attempt to keep control in a world that was rapidly escaping the individual's control. How do you keep control? Well, there again, the mountain climber and the pilot are wonderful heroes because they have control. The pilot controls the airplane, therefore he controls nature. In other words, let me put it a little differently. Because of the problem of appropriating, of keeping control, the best way to do that was to appropriate a bit of eternity. To appropriate a bit of eternity. And to get into your life a bit of eternity, which you can annex and through which you can control. So you can appropriate the skies or the mountain or whatever, the nation. But if you appropriate the nation and the skies and the mountain, you have internalized a bit of eternity. And through that bit of eternity, you have the strength to keep control in a situation which constantly escapes control. And here again, the ones who don't fit are the futurists, of course, and the expressionists, who love to ride the tail, yes? But the others, of course, don't. And here, of course, you have again the symbol of beauty, the Greek symbol of beauty, the human stereotype of beauty. All that has to do with control and restraint. It's no accident. There are no accidents in history. Everything is explainable. We are not engaged in a theological endeavor, but in a historical endeavor. So everything is explainable. Why in the middle class there is that emphasis on restraint? Restraint means control. And you are next whatever helps you control. You saw that already in Jenny Tribal. You are next manners and morals because they help you keep control. You are next the nation, you are next to the skies, you are next to nature, because it helps you keep control. And you have an idea of beauty because it helps you keep control. That is why Greek, that's why all these capitals, Greek temples and so on, why Greek architecture, because the idea of restraint was built into it. And of course, that's true even for the Bauhaus architecture itself, restraint is in. Now, of course, this is true for sexual practices as well. Through this idea of control, and the way I have said before, and I remind you of it, some homoeroticism becomes injected, of course, and woman becomes further de-emancipated into politics and into European life. Now, there are only twice when this restraint was lifted, only twice in our period, and perhaps we haven't dealt enough with either one. One was in the early Soviet Union, from about 1920 to 1924. And the other is, of course, the German Weimar Republic. Twice the restraint was lifted to a certain degree, not totally, but enough so that the subculture could come to the surface, so that the abnormal was no longer beneath the surface, but the abnormal got a place in the sun. That's the best way to put it. And in the Berlin of the 20s, which Hitler and the Nazis hated so much, obviously. In the Berlin of the 20s, you have everything that you can get. Gay life, lesbian life, all sorts of socialism, everything you want, just as you had it early in the Soviet Union. But I think the interesting thing is that it never lasted. In the Soviet Union, it lasted much less long than in the Weimar Republic. That is true. And you can, for example, write a book about homosexuality in the Weimar Republic. You cannot even write a book about lesbianism anywhere, because lesbian was so underground that there is no history. It's a history that has to be slowly recovered. Homosexuality has hardly any history at all. But you can write a book about it in the Weimar Republic, and perhaps in the early Soviet Union, because it's certain. So only twice these restraints were lifted. But that is really very little indeed. We can say, therefore, that in the end, the emphasis on community defeated individuality, but it didn't really. That in the end, the idea of community and individuality was combined with the longing for utopia of a pre-industrial sort. That explains a great deal of popular culture, but of high culture, as we've dealt with as well. That the opposition to society was an opposition to positivism. It was an opposition to an establishment which seemed to accept industrialism, which seemed just to be happy status quo, and the status quo really was unbearable. So that in a sense, however, that was a mistake. Even the establishment had this utopian element in the bourgeois, anti-bourgeois revolution. You have that. And that the idea, the difference between society and community, is really crucial here. That the war, with its myths, we dealt with its idea of camaraderie. And it's odd that in the war, where you were a conscript, you would say, you have an idea that the trenches were affinity. Nothing was less than affinity, you were conscripted. But remember, we were talking about the myth, not the reality. So after the war, this became a myth. The camaraderie of the trenches as the prototype of the camaraderie of affinity, people's high life, people's type of people's life, the exceptional, all of the things. And that meant, of course, the deepening of the male ideal. The deepening of the male as the archetype. And it meant more and more the woman in the home. It meant more and more, really, the de-enfranchising of women, which had begun with the Romantic movement already, but now, with the exception of the Weimar Republic, and to a certain extent the Soviet Union, but a very limited extent, the Soviet Union is taking place almost everywhere. There are some communist exceptions, but not many. Still, however you might put it, you have it. Now, all of this, however,
contains another, more basic element. The longing for totality. Now, it's true that probably man has always longed for totality. Yes? But this longing for totality comes with industrialization. You know, it's no accident that people live when they do. All our thoughts are historically bound. None of us think eternal thoughts unless we are as lucky as the beginners of great religion. Yes? If you have your St. Paul, that's fine. I'm looking for mine. Then your thoughts can perhaps be, you know, lifted to something. But by and large, all our thoughts are bound, earthbound. And so it is no surprise that Hegel lived when he did, at the beginning of industrialization, at the beginning of rationalization, in the Enlightenment, which tried to classify everything and rationalize everything and accept industrialization, and that Hegel became the great prophet of totality, that he believed that the longing for totality, the great prophet for totality. And if you look at Hegel and his idea that what is really bad is man is fragmented, or as he put it, of course, the division of labor. Modern society divides life. I mean, this is clear, and it's, of course, again, every myth is true. It's true. You can see that. You have to explain it. You're a different person in vacation than at work. Yes? You're a different person in the 602 club than you're washing dishes at the union. So, life is fragmented. There is a division of labor. You're not the same. If I meet you at the 602, it's not if I look into this Manchester-like tunnel in the Union and see you washing the dishes. It's a quite different thing. So, there is a division of life. The problem is it was always, but you have it always with the glorification of a past. What is more division than the old peasant? The old peasant, who had a terrible life, he plowed. His life wasn't divided because there was nothing to divide it. He didn't know leisure. And of course, Marx didn't know leisure either. So leisure is a very new concept, yes? And now we haven't perhaps talked enough about that, about tourism and leisure. It made this whole nature thing better. But I remind you that in the mid-19th century, Marx still knew no leisure. There is no Marx theory of leisure. It doesn't exist. What you have, therefore, is the idea of Hegel, the idea of a totality. You must abolish the division of labor, not in order to distribute property equally, really, but you must abolish it to get self-consciousness, to be conscious of yourself. And the idea that you cannot be conscious of what you are, of yourself, until really history has progressed, so that there is no longer a division of labor or a division of life. As long as there is no longer a division, we would say, between leisure and work, and there is no longer a division between anything. And of course, Hegel believes that this would come about with the progress of history, that at the end of history there would be a time, finally, when you would have appropriated what is yours. And what is appropriate, what is yours, is not just nature, the nation, and eternity, but your own labor as well. It's really a primitive idea of labor. It goes back to Locke, labor with your hands. But that's the only real labor, because that's labor that you can actually appropriate. It's anti-capitalism, anti-monopoly capitalism. It's a primitive economics that's involved. It goes back to Locke, laboring with your hands. But still, there it is. Now, that explains to you, perhaps, to a certain amount anyway, the Hegelian revival in Marxism after 1918. Not on the right, which didn't need it, because nationalism had always been a totality. Nationalism had always advocated that there be no division of anything, certainly no division of labor. And you get this longing for totality, the Hegelian revival of Marxism after 1918. And to put it a little differently, the quest for self-knowledge. But the quest for self-knowledge which must interact with the quest for change. But Hegel had believed that the final totality comes with the progress of history. So you've got to help history along. There has to be change. So self-knowledge is interactive with the progress of change. It means understanding existing reality, understanding existing reality as well. So that you have the totality which I have called here, the longing for a fully furnished house. That longing for a fully furnished house, which is a longing. In a sense, as I said, you have your cake and eat it too, for individualism and communism, for being an Indian on the North American plain, and yet having your dishwasher. This kind of contradictory longings which you have throughout modern cultural history is really at the basis of everything almost that we have studied. And it comes down finally to the longing to appropriate what is yourself, to the quest of men for self-consciousness, to appropriate the artificial division, the artificial. And that means the rebellion of man against positivism, against rationalization. Now, I say this all hesitantly, and remember this course asks into 1939. If I see around me in Madison, Wisconsin, not in Jerusalem, not in Rome, not in London, but in Madison, in Wisconsin, all these people who are so happy, positivists, who really believe you can solve the problems of the world by quantifying them. All this new outburst of positivism, which some later it's transitory. Some later historian will explain sometime. This outburst of positivism, I should say perhaps all that I have said, is perhaps subject to bad times. That is to say, again, I come back to what I have said. All this flourishes after 1970, because after 1970 there is political, but above all economic and social crisis. The crisis of 1873, then the crisis after the war. I assume you knew that, and that in good times you can be a happy positivist, presumably. And you can really believe in the 18th century. But after all, the 18th century, the Enlightenment itself were good times. So it certainly has a lot to do with good times and bad times in the sense of economic crisis. At the beginning of our course stands the economic crisis of 1873, the first major modern economic crisis. And of course, I don't have to tell you about the war and the post-war age. So that in a sense, perhaps this has to do, but these are pure hypotheses, that in good times, all the things that I have said are perhaps not so operative. In good times, you can do your job, you can be happy with your division of labor, but you can't quantify in bed, so I don't know what they do there. But so, in other words, there must be a certain division of labor even here. There's a computer and there's sex, at least, on a very primitive level. But anyway, they are content with the division of labor. And perhaps I should say that everything, in a sense, that we have done is crisis, because, in a sense, culture only progresses in a crisis. Nothing interesting ever happens if things go all right. That may be very, very sad for all of you, but it's still true. The most fruitful times are times of crisis. Times of dissolving certainty, not times of certainty. Well, I will go on with a few other themes next time.